also tonight Bhakti Yoga, which we translate in English as the path of devotion or love. Historians of religion like to look back to the beginnings of spirituality in India for the early origins of bhakti, and that is appropriate. Clearly, we can find themes consonant with what we understand to be this tradition of devotion back in the Rig Veda, but one sees it, I think, most compellingly in the Yajur Veda, which is that branch of the Veda which is assigned to the enactment of the ritual. Because who better than the Advaryu, the priest in that situation, who has to conduct the ritual, who has to make the symbolic gesture, making the sacrifice visible, present, dynamic, to offer it upwards to the Godhead whose grace one wants. And this Yajur Veda has a number of Upanishads attached to it. And some of those Upanishads also have strands within them which are supportive of this idea. Many people, of course, think that the Upanishads only speak about the discovery of a universal Atman or a vast impersonal Brahman in which all contraries and individualities are submerged and disappear when one attains liberation. But there are Upanishads, and we've looked at some of them, in which the personality, you could even say the personhood of the divine, is prominent. The Shvetashvatara Upanishad, probably the oldest, which does that. And in reverence to Maheshwara, who later, of course, we meet as Shiva. And the Katha Upanishad, we could take it that it is Vishnu who is being promoted and adored. So the idea of an individual soul looking for relief from suffering, for fullness of being, for the ultimate in liberation, in the direction of a great person, is part of the spiritual history of India long before Bhakti Yoga comes into being. Now there is, in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, an interesting comment that is made that becomes pertinent to how Bhakti Yoga addresses the problem of life. Because the Brihadaranyaka uses the term kama, which we normally associate as desire, as the word for love. When we really love something, we desire it, yes? So Brihadaranyaka makes a strong point that one who desires, who loves the self, gets the self. But one who desires and loves the ego and its trappings gets that. Now later, that association of kama with Atman gets lost, and that is swept away. But the idea that kama is associated only with egoistic or desire-laden affect is what continues on. And so we see that idea of kama being dealt with in the bhakti tradition. And we'll get to that. But first, let's set the table for what we see in the development of bhakti yoga. After the Upanishads, we looked at the Bhagavad Gita, which takes the general term bhakti, which existed earlier in India, and gives it a very specific meaning. Whereas bhakti might earlier have meant association, dearness, it takes a very direct turn towards personal attachment to. The meaning is restricted. The meaning becomes more precise because the Gita is trying to achieve something. It's trying to take the word bhakti, which comes, by the way, from the word bhaj, B-H-A-J, which means to participate in. So one who is a bhakta is one who participates. So there's a person who is aspiring, there is one towards whom one aspires, and there is that connection. Whatever it is that one is offering, one is connecting to that and therefore participating. The Godhead calls you to it. And we've seen that in the Bhagavad Gita. But in the Gita, Krishna, speaking as the Purushottama, says that I am established in all beings. I am everywhere at once, turning them all as if mounted upon a machine. But the idea for us is that the oneness to which Krishna Purushottama is calling the aspirant is one in which love is the culmination, an ecstatic, adorational, mystic communion, and the sense of that is that oneness is paramount. The oneness of identity by knowledge, to know that your soul is one with the divines. The identity of your heart, to know that the love that you feel is the same love that the divine feels for you. To know that living in this knowledge and in this love, that your actions betoken the divine's steps upon earth, that you are walking and working with and for the divine, that the companionship is unbroken in life. These are themes that set the early stage for what is bhakti yoga, but Krishna Purushottama refuses to allow any branching off of these paths. All lead to oneness, whether it's love or knowledge or action. They should all be there together to have a full life. This continues on. So if the Bhagavad Gita comes into full formation, say by the 2nd century CE, by the 7th or 8th or 9th, maybe the 10th century, we have the Bhagavata Purana coming into formation in North India. And it's written in mellifluous Sanskrit. It will take up much of the mythology, much of the teaching that Krishna enjoined upon listeners in the Bhagavad Gita. But before we get to the Bhagavata Purana, we have to recognize that probably the earliest form of bhakti practice in India was in the south of India, in Tamil Nadu country, practiced by those who were devotees of Shiva. So we call them Shaivites. And those who were devoted were the Alwars, Namalwars, early on, and spoke not in the language that we're familiar with in the Gita, where there's a question, there's an answer, there's another question, there's another answer. Not that sort of dialogue. But the poets are singing about their own experiences, about what they feel, about their lives and how they've turned to the divine and what that means in their experience. And this continues for centuries. The writing is in Tamil, it's in Telugu, it's in a number of regional languages, standing apart from Sanskrit, which is considered to be the courtly language, saying, no, we are of the people. And this is our experience. So rather than focusing on high metaphysical principles, these poets are singing about events and enactments of dramatic personae in their lives that were not touched upon in the great teachings of the Bhagavad Gita. And yet, they speak very much to the life of the people around them. So it gains a kind of vitality, a kind of dynamism. Around this time, if we can sort of take a side street, maybe it runs by a temple, this side street, because temples begin to come up a great deal. By then the areas of Vedic sacrifice have gone away, and the palaces of kings are beginning to give way, and money is being exchanged at temples, and temples become key to the religious and spiritual life of people. And who's allowed to come to the temple becomes a question. What are the ordinations of the classes, of the castes, etc., who are allowed to come? Who's a good devotee and who's not a good devotee? What is a cardinal feature of the bhakti movement, which everyone calls attention to, is that everyone is welcome. Because this is an experience of a universal Godhead, everybody's heart is the same. Everybody wants the same thing. Everyone's experience of the world is basically the same. But now, there is an insistence that all be allowed to come, that there be no more submission to only one caste who gets to say what is and what is not true and valid, that they have some freedom from the Brahmin class. This is not so much a fact as people have made it out to be, because there were a great number of Brahmins who were also bhaktas. They were not absent this great devotion themselves. They also wanted to participate with the divine, to have that body of the divine come into their lives. Because this was a life of embodiment. Enlightenment, to be lit up by the divine presence, did not demand that the body be annihilated. It did not demand that all of society be destroyed either. It meant that it should be vivified with the presence of the divine, that one should feel that and experience that solidly, immediately, right here and now. So there was a political shift. there was a movement towards democratization, I guess you could say, where the experience of spirituality should be given to anyone. We see an efflorescence of the bhakti movement, both north and south, that there's this old tale of in the Bhagavata Mahatmyam, following upon the Bhagavata Puranam, imaging how bhakti, seen as an aging woman, says that she began in South India, in Tamil Nadu, and went to Karnataka, and then to such and such, and finally wound up in the north. She has two sons with her. You may know this story very well. One is jnana, knowledge, and the other is vairagya, dispassion. And they're worn out and almost completely asleep, just exhausted, and she is very near exhaustion. And she's brought to Vrindavan, where she undertakes a sacrifice, but it's a sacrifice that permits knowledge and dispassion to come back into active life again, and she becomes fresh and young because she's back where she should be. So although the bhakti tradition is seen as having started down south, its proper home, its place in space and time, was meant to be primarily in Vrindavan, where Krishna had walked. And so when it gets back there, yes, that's the home, and everything grows and flourishes again. Ironically, there is a barb in there against Gujarat, of all places. Somebody must have made the poet angry about Gujarat, because they're excluded and saying this is a bad place, this is a place that did not accept bhakti. And it could be that it's an allusion to how strong the Jain tradition was there. And of course, the Jains are extreme renunciates. And on the topic of renunciation, let's come back to the tension that exists and continues to exist in the bhakti path to this day. Bhakti wants to accept the world, wants to say yes to life as it is here. But it has to deal with this problem of kama. What about this desire? It does this by a sort of means in which it accepts an ideal from sannyasa practice that we will renounce kama, we will renounce desire, and having renounced desire, then be able to experience all of life. But that renunciation of desire means that, in a sense, they have put one of the primary motifs of life at arm's length. So life denied is not life fulfilled either. Knowledge attained, if it does not become wide and all-fulfilling, is not itself complete. So this antinomy, where, yes, love is welcome, but only love of the divine, is still perceptible in the tension that exists in bhakti yoga, where its grip on life is not masterful. The other side of that, though, is that bhakti yoga, refusing to renounce the world, makes use of all manner of ordinary experiences in life to say you can experience the divine here and now. It doesn't have to be according to ritual. It doesn't have to be, in other words, at this particular place, at this particular time, and the rest of your life, you can do anything you want to as long as you make the sacrifice in the right way. If you perform the yajna, then everything is good and fine, and you can go on your life. If you go to Sunday school, you can do anything else you want the rest of the week because you have taken care of the ordination. But bhakti yoga says, no, you should be able to experience the presence of the divine anywhere and at all times. And also, the idea that one has to sacrifice, to strike off life and live purely in a spiritual reclusion where you have no contact with the rest of the world, means that you're divorced from the company of souls everywhere. And if Krishna, as he's revealed as the Purushottama in the Gita, is omnipresent, is the world itself, the cosmic platform, is every particular being in the world sort of looking out, experiencing itself as if it's not, as if it's just this thing and not really the disguised divine, but is in fact that, then why would you want to, why would you need to, why must you absent yourself from engagement and involvement in the world? So that being said, then there are a number of things that the bhaktas, the lovers, those who want to participate in the divine life, undertake to, in a sense, symbolize that I am all there, I'm with it, top to toe. And begins with listening well, sravana. Because who are you listening to? If everything is really the fluting of Krishna and calling you to it, if every voice you hear is really the Supreme speaking to you, however disguised it might be, then to listen well is part of your program. And then to yourself, give voice to it, kirtana, to sing, to say the name, to praise that. But singing requires you to lift your heart up, to open your mouth. It requires you to give voice to poetry. It requires you to give space in your heart for beauty. So the kirtana is meant to train that in you. So you listen, you sing, but not only in these little conclaves, not only in these choruses that spontaneously come or by routine come into being, but you should be capable of that moment to moment. And then, of course, smarana, to remember the divine, that everything that you see strikes some consciousness in you. Ah, the divine pretending to be a copy of Savitri, the divine pretending to be a tripod. But we have to have an active stance, the padasevam, the service of the feet of the divine. If everywhere we look, we encounter the visage of the divine, of the Purushottama. I can't speak tonight. Of the Purushottama. Then we should be able to fold our hands together and recognize that, and bow down and make pranam at those feet and wash those feet and serve, because everything is that. There is no denomination, high or low, that does not deserve our recognition of its innate divinity. And so this is communism par excellence. The recognition that this one has become multiple everywhere, and that we should embrace it, we should serve it. But we can only serve it really when we aspire to do it, but we only serve it beautifully, perfectly, when it is our real experience, when the aspiration has been realized. So we make vandana. And vandanam means that we salute. We truly salute. We not only serve, but we consciously acknowledge. Maybe we don't have to say the words, but we have really soul to soul to speak deeply, resonantly. Because we are servants. We are dasya. An army of light we are, but all in complete submission to that, but voluntary submission. There's a line in Savitri, which is famous, that Sri Aurobindo wrote. Forever love, O beautiful slave of God. And that is Savitri. That is the Divine Mother. Out of love, to be in complete service and surrender. But the Divine is not just an object above. Remember, Arjuna and Krishna were first friends and continued to be friends after he revealed himself to Arjuna. You have to have the Divine as a comrade. He has to be a playfellow. He has to be a mischievous rascal from time to time. You have to misbehave. You have to come back to the right path. You have to go through all of the feelings. In other words, this represents the normal range of human relationships. All these relationships that you have with everyone, you have really with the Divine, because that's what you're doing. You may be enacting it with this personality or that personality, but who is the personality behind that? We forget. We get lost in the play and the drama. But that's what you're trying to do. And that's what friendship symbolizes, is all of these statuses of relationship. Because to relate is the meaning of the universe. We would never bother with manifesting all of this if the one were not intentionally wishing to relate to itself in many stadia of existences. Many planes, countless beings, all of whom are intimately connected, soul level to the material. And finally, Atma Nivedana, self-surrender, the complete immolation of oneself into that fire. One gives oneself completely into the sacrificial flame. You become yourself the sacrifice. You willingly are the creature led to the giving. And you, in being consumed in that fire, are renewed in that fire. Because you, too, are eternal. One form gives way to another. One life gives way to another. Existence leads to greater existence. Light leads to greater light. And as a manifest and freed aspect of the Divine, who through kripa, grace, the Divine has anointed you with this self-knowledge and all knowledge, then you walk the worlds in service and in exaltation with the Divine. So many personalities in the middle part of India, in the span of a single century, can you imagine being on earth in the span of one lifetime? Ramananda, Tulsidas, Kabir, Guru Nanak, Mirabai, Chaitanya, every one of them speaking about a different experience of the divine through the primacy of the heart. Not abolishing knowledge, because none of them renounced knowledge. Chaitanya was himself a great student, a master of erudition. But we remember him for the life that he led, not for a word that he taught. He left no teaching, just a few utterances that one of his chief disciples hurriedly scribbled down. But the rest of it was a personal example of how do you live in communion with the divine? Through rhythms in which the divine presence became more and more palpable and manifest, so much so that it shook the body to pieces, and then slowly ebbing away, and that impact of the immediate presence would relieve itself so that human body could persist a while. And then he was merely the devotee, merely the lover of God again. And then again, would come that same gripping power. Gaura, the golden one. Maybe he was born that way, but to be golden means to be truthful, means to be of the color of the sun, of that illumination. So Chaitanya, the name means one who is truly conscious. That was the name he took after his awakening. Was one of the great examples of how humanity can lead itself to participate in divinity. He is regarded as an Amsha avatar. Amsha means portion, that he could portionally represent the divine. There were moments in which his human personality was gone, and only the divine was there. Only the divine spoke. Only the divine smiled. Only the divine sang and danced. And then, back to the human. So it is an indication that one who has that full liberation doesn't abandon the human form, but continues to dwell in it, admitting into the human vehicle what light is possible for it. And I'm wandering a little from my topic when I mention that rare is the illuminant who can long stay in the human body, having attained that consciousness. The human frame can withstand the impact of the mental consciousness for 70 years or so. 70, isn't that what they say? But if you pour an ocean instead of a river through it, how long can it last? Can it bear it? So that we have sages with us for only a while, and they only manifest the direct rays of that sunlight from time to time. It speaks to the body's fallibility. They have to work through the human body like we do. But it speaks also to our failing capacity to receive, because we don't invite that. I know I'm beginning to really wander now, but how many times have I listened to people say, I regret so much having put upon Sri Aurobindo or the mother or Ramana Maharshi this stupid question or that stupid question, or told them this problem or that problem, asking them to resolve my little human complaints, when what I should have been asking for was, give me a breath of that grace, show me what that consciousness is like. What do I have to do to attain this? And instead, we fritter our time away, worried about trifles, when the great things lie in front of us and we forget. We can only receive what we ask for. It won't be imposed upon us. So those spiritual opportunities, when they come, we have to seize with both hands. Even outside of our own tradition, let me mention Gurdjieff, whom you'll know from the Central Asian and Russian mystical traditions, a modern example. I know people that knew him. And one of the interesting things was, you know, he lived such a life of dissipation and ruination of his body that towards the end of the life, he was just a shell of what he had been. But if the moment came where he had to manifest, where it was clear that a moment had arrived, where the soul had to step forward, then he could throw off that shambling wreck of a human figure that he had and become again the spiritual giant. Show again that robustness of vitality. Show again what that universal world looked like before us, what we might become. And having served the purpose at that moment would fade again. Well, they all fade from us eventually, all the illuminates. And Chaitanya also passed, as did Mirabai, as did Tulsidas, as did Ramananda. But the idea that we can participate in the Godhead, that we can have an adorational oneness with that which really has no name, persists today. I say it like that because we're very aware of what has been in modern parlance called the saguna bhakti, that we worship the divine by name, that we call him Krishna, that we call him Rama. But there is the other tradition, which is also part of the bhakti path, which is nirguna, which ultimately says that that divine has no name. In Kabir, in Guru Nanak. And Tulsidas ultimately also said, just the name, just that holy name. Don't bother me with any imaging. Don't bother me with any archana, image worship. I think I forgot to mention that. The image that we worship is always of that one. That one which meets us in the way we can best receive it, the idea of the Ishta Devata, that it reveals itself to us in conformity with our capacity. That if we can only get it that way, it reveals itself only that way. But if you can see it as it is, it will show you a representation of what it would look like as a universal figure. And that Vishnu Vishvarupa, which Arjuna saw on the field of Kurukshetra, you better be ready for it, because it is all-encompassing. And Daivik and Asuric and everything beyond it. So opening the heart should open the mind, should open us to action, so that again we wind up affirming life. This is what was taught in the Veda. This is what really was the goal of the Upanishads. This is what was reaffirmed in the Gita to stand against what was a growing tradition of renunciation, again addressed in the great tradition of the Tantra, and now again brought forward to the center stage in Sri Aurobindo's Integral Yoga. So the question is always, how do we realize the divine in our lives here and now? Any form that is significant to you, anything that takes you there, is welcome in its essence. Don't be married to any particularity, because to be alive to the spirit means that it may be in your hand one moment and out of your hand the next. So attachment, none. A worshipful embrace of the divine in all things? Yes. Living from your soul outwards. Indispensable. So I think next week maybe I'll say a few summary words about what we've done over these last few months. But we'll begin to move towards our study of the life divine with a look at the work that Sri Aurobindo was doing in Pondicherry before the mother came, before the Arya was launched. The 15th of August is approaching. And it will mark 100 years since Sri Aurobindo proclaimed in print the life divine. So if you have some questions,